That's their disclosure statements, right?
For criminals.
You know, the disclosure statements, they have to...
All of them?
Yeah, for everybody, yeah. Yes. Do it with Invesco. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for being so patient with us.
Thank you for allowing us in.
I know that you know a lot of the board members already, but there are some new ones, so I wanted to give an opportunity for us to introduce ourselves again, and then I'm going to turn the meeting over to you. We actually have you scheduled for 40 minutes, but as crisp as you want to make it, it's fine. We'll ask our questions, too. I'll start with Gabe and...
Gabe Rodriguez.
Deborah Allen.
Trustee Watts, trustee.
Jerry Tellis.
Maria Teresa. Trustee Marilyn just stepped out for a minute. She'll be right back.
John Phillips, trustee.
Jerry Holcomb, trustee.
And Terry just stepped out
Terry
a minute. He'll be back. Great. Bob? Okay. One thing, just sort of housekeeping. This is a public meeting. We need you to, this says confidential, so we need your ability to make this disclosed to the public.
Absolutely. We completely waive our confidentiality rights with this board.
Right. Thank you so much.
Also, you should know that we are now recording our meetings.
Yes.
And those are publicly available.
Yeah. It's very recent, so we often forget. And if you look on your table, you'll notice a little microphones because I tend to throw my stuff on it, too. So you might want to be mindful of that.
Sujit's
otherwise,
to keep
we'll get to
it. Sujit may not be waiving his confidentiality. Let's confirm
don't feel bad. I think I started with water and then I began with books. So, yeah. I did. So I'll let you go and start where you want to.
Great. Thank you very much. And let me start before I even introduce us. Let me just start by thanking you so much for having us in. This means a lot to us. So we've been working for the Retirement Board for a long time now. And we truly appreciate the opportunity to come in and present our new fund. So it means a lot to us. Thank you very much. So in terms of introductions, to my far right is Sujit Sitoli. And Sujit's a member of our acquisitions team. And he's been with us now for 7 years. And we wanted to have him out here for two reasons. First, because he's an important member of our acquisitions team. And second of all, if we're fortunate enough to have you visit us for an on-site at the end of next week, Sujit's actually going to be on a delayed honeymoon with his wife, so we figured we want to have an opportunity to introduce Sujit today.
Well, they all got to go.
Well, I was actually willing. If you'll say the word, we'll try to delay it. His wife wasn't quite as forgiving.
Get used to it.
That's right.
We'll
right.
I think of some honeymoon gift for that. I don't know.
And Michael Elizondo to my right. Michael really heads our group, and Michael and myself, Jeff Gandel, we've been with the group from the beginning, back from early 1995. So again, thank you for having us in. And we will walk through this book in a crisp fashion. So we'll do it quickly, and then, of course, we assume that there'll be questions where you want to drill in a little deeper. Okay? So the first few pages, I'll dive right in. On page four, we have a couple of pages giving you a quick look at the organization. Now, some of this is going to look redundant to when we were in at the end of March, giving you an update on the two prior funds. But on page four, you can see a timeline of the group. And as we mentioned when we were here in March, you can see that we ran a series of funds for many years inside of Fidelity. And back at the end of 2008, as the board, I'm sure, recalls, we essentially, for all intents and purposes, became independent at that time, at the end of 2008. The spin-out was legally formalized in mid-2011, so formally on July 5th, 2011, we became Long Wharf Real Estate Partners. And so now we've been running for about 2 years, officially as Long Wharf Real Estate Partners. We finished investing Fund 3 in the middle of last year, and we began investing Fund 4 at the end of 2012. And now here in 2013, we're investing exclusively on behalf of Fund 4, which is what we'll talk about today. The next page five, a couple bullet points on our group. And I think these, if you look at them in total here, I think they present a unique set of attributes for a group like Long Wharf. First and foremost, we're a focused investment boutique. We do one thing only, value-added U.S. real estate. That's all that we do. We have quite a bit of experience on our team. So if you think about the members of our investment committee, We now have, we average over 22 years of real estate investment experience, and we have about 15 years of experience working together with our team. As I mentioned, in terms of focus, we do one thing. So value-added real estate, and we invest one fund at a time. We don't have any separate accounts. We don't have any other strategies. This fund that we're investing right now has not only the complete attention of our group, but the absolute priority over every investment opportunity that we look at. In terms of alignment, it's tough to imagine a group being more aligned with its investors than how we are now. So in addition to the employees owning 100% of the management company, the employees own 100% of the general partner in the new fund. And as you can see here, the senior principals of the group are making a very meaningful personal investment in the fund. That's in the fund as an investor in the fund. But even in addition to that, if you think about the carried interest that hopefully this fund will generate, we allocate that throughout the entire team. So regardless of whether somebody on our team is investing personally or not, everybody on our team is an owner of this fund and they participate in the carried interest. So we think that creates a tremendous alignment of interest. Last thing I'll mention is even though we are this focused, independent boutique, at the same time, we have built out what we think is a best-in-class infrastructure. And I think part of that is due to the years we had at Fidelity and the importance of having that infrastructure. But as we built out all of the systems and systems that are really dedicated to what we do, private equity, real estate, the infrastructure in total we think is best in class for what we do. And again, hopefully if you do visit us at the end of next week, we'll be able to show you those systems in person. One last piece on the organization on page 6, you can just see our org chart here. So everybody you see on this page, whether it's on the acquisition side, the asset management side, or the operation side to the right, everybody here is focused on one thing, on value-added real estate, one fund at a time. So we feel that this group is very well resourced to execute our strategy. All right, so now we'll shift over to the fund. So on page 8, we have a few bullet points introducing the fund, and then Michael and Sujeet will talk a little bit more about our strategy. But at a high level, what this fund is it's really a continuation of what we've been doing for you in Fund 3 over the past 3 years. So if you think about all the investments that we've made from 2010 forward, coming out of the downturn, this is a continuation of that. And what we're really doing coming out of the downturn is we're capitalizing on the mispricing between non-stabilized and stabilized assets. And so that's really the crux of what we're trying to do. And of course, we'll get into specifics and show you specific investment examples. So there's a few things about this fund that we think are important. One, the fund size. So we expect the fund to end up around $250 million, could be a little bigger, but around $250 million or so. Well, we feel that is a great size for our strategy because it gives us flexibility. It gives us flexibility to selectively do some larger investments, but it doesn't impose a weight of capital that forces us to do bigger investments. So we can keep doing the types of investments that we've been doing for 18 years now that have been very successful, smaller to mid-size investments that may be $10 or $15 or $20 million of equity. So it doesn't force us to just do big investments. We can do different types. One other thing I'll mention on the fund, and this is really under the second paragraph here, is I think one of the things unique is that we have this in-place portfolio of existing assets. And so we've committed about $55 million of equity to 4 different transactions. There's more properties than that, but 4 overall transactions. And in the time that we've made these investments, so over the past 9 months or so, we've had a tremendous amount of progress at these investments. And because of that, we have a good bit of visibility as to what we expect the returns to be for a number of these assets, including one investment, and Michael mentioned, that we expect to sell shortly. So this, I think, allows investors who are coming in now before our final close, and I know the time frame's a little tight, but allows our investors to participate in a good bit of upside very quickly based on the in-place portfolio. And in addition to the in-place portfolio, we also have a very attractive pipeline of investment opportunities. I know that we've given 3 different examples to Tim and Chi-Chi to look at. In addition to those 3, we have other investments as well in our pipeline that we're working on. And again, if you do visit us next week, we can show you our entire pipeline, all the different things that we're currently working on.
So if you will, let's move to page 9. And I think we discussed this a little bit last time we were here because, as Jeff said, this is really a continuation of what we've been doing for you at the end of Growth Fund 3. And this strategy has really been in place since the end of 2009-10. And I think I will expect it to continue out for the next couple of years as well in this. And I think the backdrop from which we were working was that we were expecting the economy to, as I've typically said, kind of muddle along, but really kind of have very little direction at this point. And that's something that we were looking at. We were not looking to just buy assets and hope that all boats would rise. We really was looking at, let's buy assets and let's buy them right. And so what we've really done is we bought high-quality assets, good locations, and we bought them at such a low basis that we're able to be predatory in our lease-up of those assets. So it's kind of under-stabilized or under-leased assets, and we're buying those, leasing them, and then because the overall market has been so strong as far as core money coming into our space, we've really gotten these assets ready and we're selling them to the core buyers. The frothiness of the core buyers, the queues to get into the core funds is actually so strong. It's not something that we underwrote, and again, if you dig in deep on us, you'll see that's not the way we expected to exit it, but if it continues, then we'll continue to exceed the expectations at this point. On the next page, as Jeff kind of said, you know, we're taking advantage of the mispricing and unstabilized assets, and that's what this graph is really trying to depict. So if you look at the graph itself, and then I'll kind of give you a little bit of color around it, but on the bars on the graph here, what they're really showing is that if you look at the axis on the left, it's showing you that in the early part of the 2000s, we were looking at a discount from less than 75% leased assets to core stabilized assets of being somewhere between 30 and 40%. You can see in the last few years, what we're really seeing is almost double that. So the discount to those core stabilized assets is closer to 50 to 60%. So again, we think that we're being well paid for the risk we're taking, but I'd even take it a step further in which is saying, I think what we're able to do is we're actually able to mitigate the risk because of the fact that we're going in at such a low basis. We're not assuming rent growth on these assets. We're actually buying an asset and assuming that it'll take us 2 to 4 years to lease it up to some stabilized position, and we're potentially looking at even a lower rent than today's market, but at least at today's market or slightly lower. So again, we're not betting on rent growth, because to me, rent growth means that we've got to have some level of job growth, and we're not in the business of predicting job growth. And it would be nice to have had it occur 3 years ago. Still don't have it in a meaningful way across the country. And so, you know, we're looking at this and saying, can we do it on today's rent numbers?
Throw a percentage on lease up. What are you talking about when you say lease up?
I'll do both sides of it. So we've done everything from an empty building to probably an 85% leased building. And then to get, though, to what I think you're saying, you know, where how far are you taking it?
Yeah.
I don't think we've underwritten anything to go anywhere beyond a 90 or 92%, but it's not typical for us to get, not atypical for us to get about 85% occupied. So
that's the occupation. Say you buy the building, the current lease is $100 a square foot.
Okay.
You're going to up it to what? 125 a square foot, so it's going to be a 25% what?
I actually, using your numbers on that, I would say actually we're looking at it probably going down to 85. So if you buy it at 100,
yeah,
rents in most markets, and again, we haven't done multifamily, so I'll discuss that specifically if you want me to. But if you look at office, retail, and industrial, one of the things, think about retail, for example. One of the beauties to me about what we've been able to do is we're buying it about 40 cents on the dollar to what it costs to build.
Okay.
So it's not unusual for somebody to have built it, leased it at rents to get them to a return they want. We're buying it at 40 to 50 cents on the dollar. We can roll down.
Oh, you can roll it down.
And so.
So you're getting tenants that are thinking they're getting. Okay.
So you know, actually, I love where you're going, because to me, it's always been about being able to give tenant a value proposition. Mm-hmm. So when you go out and you give a tenant, we're literally walking into centers that we bought 85% leased, and they're at $30 to $38 a foot. What? We're moving them down to $18 to $28 a foot.
Oh, they're loving you.
They love it.
And they're saying, hey, come and stay here.
And they're telling their buddies, come stay here. But they're also giving us longer-term leases.
Okay.
So we're able to kind of come in and restructure it all.
Okay.
So that was part of it, was we really didn't want to bet on that job, that rent growth, which, again, I think of as job growth at the end of the day. Now, multifamily we haven't done. I'll let Sajid talk about it. Multifamily we haven't done because you have to look at rent growth where it's priced.
But does that hurt when you go to sell the building? Because now you've put it at a certain price.
Right.
If you want to get the premium price, are they going to be saying, well, gee, these leases that we have at 100% lease are lower than we really need them to be?
So I think you're onto something in that what they'll pay is less per square foot at the end of the day, but they'll actually pay you a higher cap rate or lower cap rate or a higher multiple because they're looking at it and they think there's upside in the rents.
Right.
And so they're more aggressive on that. And so I think it's interesting, and I don't mean to get too far off on tangent, but I do think that it's very interesting this time in that all of the assets were not repriced. The ones that we're buying, we're repricing. But if an asset was fully leased, and your market's one of the kind of poster children for this, if it was fully leased, the value dropped and it's back up here. We're buying it at here and we're selling it and we're actually underwriting exiting it less than where it probably traded for the last time and less than what it would cost to build it new. So I think there's a intrinsic value play, and I hope that the buyer looks at it like you did, mm-hmm. which is, well, I'm not paying 300 a foot for it, I'm only paying 240 a foot for it, and there's this headroom in there. We like that because we assume that we would exit down at the probably 220 a foot. So I think that this chart is just kind of showing that the pricing hasn't really recovered for the less stabilized assets. Okay. The next page 11. Is just getting a little bit more granular with it, and then I'll quit getting more granular here at this point. And again, I like this one because it's the progression of what we're actually doing. We're stepping in where assets were over-leveraged, they're having to be repriced. We're typically buying it from a lender or from a service or an asset that's already been repriced or recapped with their existing operating partner. So the basis is lower, and as I said, we're down less than 50 cents on the dollar to what it costs to build. And we're resetting that basis, and again, I think that's really important here because the fact that everybody didn't reprice, and again, I remember the early 90s when everything got repriced. This time you've got a competitive advantage, and so you can be very predatory in your lease up in this. And I think, again, maybe the most important part of the strategy to me is if we are able to get these assets to where, on an unlevered basis, their income is a 9 or 10% return, so it's a yield on cost. So if I always think about this as everything it costs, it took to get me fully leased in a building, if that building's throwing off a 10% return unlevered, everything else works just fine. Because again, if you think about where the core market is today, they'll buy that same asset at a 5 to a 7% yield, and we're sitting there in our portfolio with a little over a 10, I think, in the existing portfolio that we bought in the end of Growth Fund 3. So yeah, again, I think it's always worked. I've been doing this for a long time, and it's always worked if I've got a good quality asset, good market, and I can throw off a 10 yield.
What's your turnover time? What's your turnover time? You buy a building, you do this in 3 years, 5 years?
You know, the average is probably somewhere between 3 and 4.
Thank you.
We're doing some quicker than that, and we'll talk about one here in a moment. So.
Okay.
On page 12, so where are we executing this strategy? So we're focused and we're going to remain focused on larger markets that have proven liquidity and where the fundamentals are improving. And some markets like Dallas are seeing some job growth, and we made some investments there. And we're going to continue to work in markets like San Francisco and New York, but we're not going to be focused exclusively on the gateway markets where we've seen pricing already absolutely take off. So we are going to be able to uncover some opportunities there. We're also going to look for value in other markets that have a diversified economy and have deep liquidity, you know, markets like Dallas, markets like Denver and Boston, and some of those markets we've been active with in the past couple of years. In terms of property type, we've seen the most value in office, industrial, and retail, as Michael mentioned. So we're able to lease up in those property types to that 9% plus yield on cost without getting to rent growth, and that's what Michael was talking about. Now, as Mike also mentioned, on the lowest end of the scale, you see the multifamily. In multifamily, the fundamentals have been strong, but pricing has been even more strong. So in order to get anywhere close to a 9% yield on cost, you've got to have a whole lot of rent growth. And you're probably still getting to something like a 6 or a 7%. So then in order to get to your returns, on top of that, you've got to add quite a bit of leverage. So I think we're really comfortable that the relative value is in office, retail, and in industrial to some extent. I think we continue to see that opportunity for Fund 4 going forward, particularly in office and retail.
Is that true in both your primary markets and the secondary markets, or are you looking at something different in the secondary markets?
Well, I think in we want to make sure all of the markets have a true kind of deep level of liquidity. I think you obviously do expect there to be some premium to be able to purchase in New York, San Francisco, or Washington, D.C., relative to something like a Denver. So we do expect to see some level of higher return. But I think one thing we want to stay focused on is basically being in a market that has liquidity, being in a market that has a truly diversified economy, and then being able to underwrite. You know, maybe if you're in, you know, San Francisco, you might be underwriting more like an 8 or 9% return on cost on an asset that you just know you can lease and there's very little risk and you know what the rents are. Whereas maybe in Denver, you're looking to try to get to that 10% plus return on cost. And you'll see we have a range of kind of that 9 to 11 to 12%. And some of that is at least market driven.
Okay.
And if your question also was around product type, I think product type does cycle through in various markets. So industrial, and that's one of the reasons I think Sajit was kind of saying he wasn't pounding the table that he's going to do a lot of industrial going forward, is industrial is one of those that turns quickly as well. And so, you know, you certainly aren't going to find it in the major markets right now priced the way we would like to see it, because everybody, when it gets priced too much for us, it means that somebody's pricing in rent growth. And so I do think that, yes, it's different market to market. And for example, we've recently done a suburban office building in the LA market, which clearly fits the strategy. Hard for us to find an industrial in that market, I think. And again, I think we will find retail, because until the consumer feels good about buying again, retail is going to be one of those that's continuing to shake out. So, if you don't mind, we'll turn to page 14, and we'll go through. There are four examples here, and these are the four investments that are already in Growth Fund 4, and they are going through some positive value add situations. This first one I'll start with is the Dallas office portfolio. And actually, Deborah and Marilyn, two years ago.
Last fall.
Went to these or the other adjacent building?
Okay.
So you actually saw the quad. Because this is three buildings and a four building project, and we actually bought the first building that's not part of this several years ago, going through a full lease up and about to sell that one. But this one was an interesting portfolio, three buildings owned by Bank of America. Bank of America was attempting to offload some of their facilities, actually doing that, I think, a good bit quite across the U.S. They were selling 500,000 square feet. Of the 500,000 square feet, 300,000 of it, however, was on a short-term lease. It was really an 18-month lease. And so the market priced it as if they had a long-term lease for 200,000 square feet, 10-year, good credit, good term. But the other 300,000 was actually only on 18 months. We looked at it. We knew the tenant that was in our existing building, which is State Farm, needed to expand. We worked with State Farm to get State Farm to take on the additional 300,000 square feet after B of A left. We actually had to do a little more than that. We had to shorten the B of A time frame, extend out the State Farm time frame. So now what we really wound up doing is we bought something that I always think of as we bought something that the market wasn't pricing. The market was pricing 60% of this campus being vacant in 18 months. We got long-term credit leases for those two buildings, and therefore we bought it. We have already leased it. By the time we had gone hard and closed on this, we had leases with B of A, leases with State Farm, and again, very strong kind of expiration schedule. We've actually gone out to market. We've got quite a bit of interest in it, and this one I expect to be sold sometime in July, and the returns will be very strong. And if we were not being recorded, I'd tell you exactly where it is. but I will say for the recording that we have
quite a few other backup bids on this, but it will be extremely accretive to the fund, and obviously we're very excited about it. And so, again, I think it was just one of those where we stepped in and bought something that wasn't there. Total cost, including leverage on this one, because, was actually closer to $70
million.
Yes, and it's we've got we used the line as well a little bit on this, and because we had one of the buildings in for a 10-year B of A loan lease, we put a higher loan on that one, expecting to sell it immediately. So our original exit strategy had a little going here, a little going there, a little going there. When we put it all together, the sum of the parts was clearly, we think, more valuable than the independent pieces, and therefore we're just going to sell the whole thing. So we actually did kind of work this one to have less equity going in than typical.
But you had 10-year leases where you could hold it, too.
That's right.
Hypothetical. If Contra Costa were to make an investment in this fund and you flip this building in July, do we get a distribution?
Yeah.
You do.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's why we the time frame for our final closing came a little quicker here than we thought, because this sale is happening a little sooner than we thought. But yes, absolutely. Yep.
Thank you for asking that question, Jerry.
So that one obviously feels very good, and we're far down the road on that one at this point. We've got a negotiated LOI, and we're actually trading purchase and sell agreement right now. The next page has some similarities, I think, to the previous one. This is, however, it's a retail deal in the Houston market.
Close.
And in a good, strong retail area. And this one was built in the late 90s, actually 1999. And it was built for about $140 to $150 a foot. We paid about $64 a foot for it. We bought this, and the whole lease-up strategy, just because of Jerry's question, we assumed that by 2015 we would have this lease to about 85%, and we're at about 85 today, and I think that by the end of the year we'll be probably right at 90%, so higher than we ever expected it to get, but that's good, and so we'll take that as it is. But again, this is one where we went in, the market around us, their basis is about $150 to $250 a foot. And again, we bought it at 64. We'll be all in at about $90 a foot. And we're able to be, you know, my term predatory, we're able to be extremely aggressive for the tenants. And it goes back to this point of, to me, value for the tenant. We literally brought in 100,000 square feet of tenants because we were able to cut their rent by about 40%. And so we put that together before going hard again. So again, it was something that really wasn't there in the market and feels very strong right now. This one's, we went in with over an 11 unlevered yield on it, even with the low leasing that we had, and we've now just pushed that up much higher. So very strong again.
On page 16, this next portfolio in Atlanta, it's a four-building portfolio totaling 280,000 square feet. And it was about 33% occupied when we bought it just at the end of the year in December of 2012. We purchased it for $30 a square foot relative to the replacement cost of $90 a foot. So this was a really deep value transaction. And these are smaller, single-story office flex buildings, but they're quality buildings and they're in good submarkets. So because of that basis, again, $30 a foot is just extraordinarily, extraordinarily cheap. You know, this is a great example of our ability to buy something cheap and because of that, get some really quick leasing. Now, when we pro forma this stabilizing at occupancy of 90% out in 2015, we think that the three smallest buildings, which are around 60,000 square feet each, those three buildings will be leased up by the end of this year. And then once we lease up the fourth building, we'll actually get to an 11 or 12% yield on cost on this portfolio. And we're going to have the option of selling the buildings in kind of little packages or individually or in one large package. We'll have a great exit here, and we anticipate that'll get us towards a 2x multiple on this one. This is just deep value.
Second bullet. Guy builds a building. There's no money left for commissions or TIs. So is that like buying a car and not being able to put gas in it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is.
Yes.
And it's interesting. It was basically a European syndicate who actually did build-to-suits on these buildings. They built them for around $90 a foot. They built it. They had a tenant. At some point, the tenant shrunk out, and these were syndicates where basically the money was supposed to flow one way to Europe and not going to go back into the property. So they actually didn't have money to put back for leasing, for capital improvements, for anything. And just the property kind of went by the way. They've actually shrunk out of the market. They're not even in the Atlanta market anymore.
Okay.
A few years ago, there was a... It was a term that was kind of created, the zombie buildings, and I think that's exactly kind of. And so sometimes I think I get a little concerned because it does. They're not zombie because of
people
what
in
they look like or people. In them. It's exactly this, where the capital, the equity is gone, and they're not going to put any more money into it, and the banks or the servicers are they're unintended owners. They didn't mean to be there, and having them kind of. Go back and go. We're gonna fix up this building and we're gonna lease it. Not a lot of people want to take that one to a committee. And so if it's leased, it works well for them. Cash flowing, they sell it. The ones that aren't leased well is really the issue. And so those are the ones that we're able to kind of reprice. So.
Okay. This next one, the Denver Industrial Office Campus. So yes. This is a 1.2 million square foot corporate campus in Denver. 300,000 square feet of office and 900,000 square feet of industrial, and it sits on 105 acres. So this is an enormous site in infill, just 15 minutes north of downtown Denver. It's a 1.2 million square foot building,
but
we're purchasing it for under $6 million. So that equates to $5 a foot on the building, and if you just scraped the entire building and pretended it wasn't there, it's $1.25 a land foot. Now, industrial land, which is on the cheaper side, out here trades to $3 to $5 a foot. So this is just kind of incredibly, incredibly deep value here. And the beauty is it's not only cheap, it's actually very, very well located. It's just off the freeway at a major intersection in Westminster at the 25 and 120th Street. The area is actually not truly an industrial-only area because it's moved on and it's become residential and office as well, so it's very infill. And our plan here is pretty simple. What we can do on this big site is we can reconfigure the property, and the base plan is to reconfigure that 900,000 square feet of industrial down to 500,000 square feet. And that 500,000 square feet on this site, if we lease that up, we get to a 10 yield on cost. So just the 500,000 square feet. Now, in addition to that, we basically got a 300,000 square foot office building on the site for free. And on top of that, we've got about 50 acres of developable land next to a park and ride in Denver, around residential areas, on a busy street next to the field. So this is kind of an incredible opportunity to get gravy up and above that kind of mid-teens return on the industrial. Now, right now on the office building, we are in negotiations with a tenant that would take the entire building, and we're in competition with someone else, and that's a build-to-suit, actually. So their options are going to be us, which our costs are almost nothing except for what we need to put into the building to get the tenants there versus a build-to-suit. Now, because of that, we can be as predatory on rents as we need to be, and we think we can offer rent that's almost half of what the competition offers. So we feel very confident that we're going to be able to create some value just by offering something that's so much cheaper. So that's over and above the 10% yield on cost on the industrial. And after that, the site is so big, you've still got 50, maybe a little bit more like 55 acres of infill land here. And the best way we can maximize the value on that would be to turn it into multifamily land. So we have actually taken the beginning steps to entitle that as multifamily. Now, we would not develop that, but again, relative to the $1.25 a land foot that we paid, the $3 a foot that industrial land trades for, that land would probably be worth in the neighborhood of $10 a foot.
So you just sell it with the entitlement?
We just sell it with the entitlement. So we're in the beginning process of that. We've gotten major approval to head that direction towards somewhere around 300 units. So this is a great one because your base case is stripping it down to just the industrial building, which is right off the freeway, very infill, very unique. And then everything beyond that is gravy, and we've got a ton of optionality. We think we're going to working towards a lease on the office, and then we've also got this opportunity on multifamily. There's probably some extra land after that we're going to be able to sell as well.
This seems like entirely a cost of money. question. I mean, how long can you sit on a see-through building, and how long can you wait for the zoning authority to give you the clearance you need? You're going to...
Well, we have no debt, so we bought unlevered, so there's no debt accruing. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. So that obviously gives us a good flexibility. But we went into our assumptions going in, our base case returns, assume that we tear down the office building. So going in, we got the whole thing. And as a matter of fact, tearing down the office building because we bought this from a big corporate user. They left so much stuff in the office building that the demolition companies will take the stuff in the office building. It'll cost essentially nothing to tear it down. And in terms of the land, we went into it assuming base case that we don't get anything for the land. So all of this is just upside to our going in assumptions. Although I will tell you, going in, we probably thought there was some good stuff that was going to happen, and sure enough, that's developing now. But importantly, there's no debt on it right now, so there's no cost of capital that's accruing.
And during that time frame that you're talking about, because you're right, I think that, you know, this has got so much intrinsic value that I'm not concerned. So much headroom, the way I think of it, that this is not kind of eating away at you. But having said that, we also structured a lease back with the seller so that they're in there for a year. So while we're going through this entitlement process and cleaning it up and everything else, we've actually got a tenant in there because the tenant needed it for... It's kind of one of these, again, this was slightly different than one where I was talking about kind of the zombie buildings. This is a corporate seller that looks at this and says, we've got an extremely expensive campus to run because we're only using 35,000 square feet out of the 1.2 million. But they're having to turn lights, heating, air conditioning on the whole site. And so they're paying us for the next year to solve all that problem.
We're actually not paying a penny in expenses right now, and we actually, you know, the redevelopment here is not heavy lifting. The space is just being delivered to the market now, so the new space is actually, the industrial portion is starting to be ready to lease right now while the previous owner is paying for our carry costs here.
I think I ever want to play poker with these guys. Something tells me that if you were ever an organ donor, I'd have to pay you for having housed
organ,
the organ for the
I'm
first 45 years.
I'd be happy to give it to you.
Rental space for my heart.
Okay, so we have other examples in here from the prior fund. We weren't planning on going into those. So if you have any questions in any part of that, we're happy to. But
they're buying distressed.
Could you just walk us through your fee structure one more time before you close today?
Sure.
Just so we're all sure.
Sure. Of course. I will say all these Fund 3 examples, though, that you see in there, you already own these because they're in Fund 3. So.
Right.
And they're all doing very well, for what it's worth. Which, of course, is part of the reason why we picked them. So page 24, the terms. So, as I mentioned before, so we're approaching our final closing here, which is really dictated by both the sale of the Dallas campus as well as some value markups that will be done in the third quarter on some of the other assets as well. So we're approaching final close, which is coming quicker than we had originally thought. So at the end of the day, as I mentioned before, we expect the fund to end up around $250 million. We're targeting a return to our investors net of all fees and expenses of 12 to 15%, so that's net of everything. And then if we go down to the fees, so similar with our prior funds, there's only two fees. Okay, so there's the base management fee and then our performance fee, and I'll explain them, but no other fees whatsoever. And just to reinforce any other revenue we could possibly generate in our investment activities goes to the fund, goes to the investors and not to us. Okay, so there's no other revenue coming to us other than the base management fee, which covers our overhead, and then the performance fee if we achieve our objectives.
And we don't have affiliate companies doing management fees or disposition fees or anything else.
That's right. So the management fee is 1% on the committed but unfunded capital, and then 1.5% on the amount that's been funded. So that's the management fee. And then the performance fee, similar to all of our prior funds, so we have to return back all of your investment plus a 10% annual preferred return on that. If we've returned back all of your investment plus the 10% annual return, and we've achieved returns in excess of that, then we participate in the profits above that, so that hopefully at the end of the day, we've earned a 20% carried interest if we've achieved our objectives. But the simplest way to look at it is that if the fund only generates a 10% annualized return on your investment, it all goes to you and we don't earn any performance fee.
It's an 8-year closing. Are there any extensions just in the contract? It's an 8-year fund, right?
Yeah, 8-year fund life. We have the ability to extend for 1 year on our own, and any extensions after that require the approval of the investors.
Okay. So 1 year on our own. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brilliant job in our time frame. Thank you.
Thanks,
you can come up and introduce yourself for a minute with our board members if you'd like, as you go around the circle, and then we're going to have our discussion and probably make a decision today.
Great. Thanks again for having us.
We'd like to stay.